Good? Okay. Hi, good evening, ladies and gentlemen and distinguished guests. Thank you for joining us this evening for our public meeting of the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service. There's two housekeeping items that I need to get over with before we get started. So please note there are two fire exits, actually three, I guess, in case there's an emergency so we can get out all safely. Additionally, please be aware that we are audio recording our event today, and we will be taking photos to share on our social media channels. So just if you show up on our hashtag on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, you'll know why. But let me get started. My name is Deborah Wada, and I am the Vice Chair for Military Service, as well as one of the 11 commissioners. And four of my fellow commissioners are here with me today. We're here to visit Chicago this week. I will be your MC for tonight's meeting, and I'm very excited to welcome all of you this evening. So Illinois is home to an estimated 44,000 military members, over 643,000 veterans, 848 government employees, 848,000 government employees, and 15,000 individuals who serve in national service programs, including AmeriCorps and Senior Corps. And Chicago, Illinois is the city known for its service spirit, as well as momentum and opportunity. Inglewood residents understand the importance of service. There are many organizations working together to improve the economic vitality of Inglewood community, and we were lucky this morning to meet with a number of organizations and people from the community that are doing great work and learning all about it this today. So I also want to mention that our venue here at the Kennedy King College is one of seven city colleges of Chicago, which embodies the commitment to academic excellence and civic responsibility espoused by its namesake, slain civil and human rights activists Robert F. Kennedy and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So millions of Americans volunteer and engage in service every day. Yet there is more we can do and more ways to participate, more ways to embed service in the very fabric of civic engagement, which brings me back to what the Commission is going to do over the next several years. The Commission is tasked to focus on two primary areas. The first is the evaluation of the military selective service system, and if there is a continued need for the program or if it should be updated or disestablished. The second task, part of the selective service review will also include whether we should, if we continue to have a selective service, whether we should include women in the mandatory registration. The second task of the commission will undertake exploring ways in how we can increase and inspire individuals' desire and interest to serve. And Congress has asked us to consider all forms of service, whether that's military, national, or public service. And the commission intends to listen to the public to understand how Americans feel about service and the selective service system. We want to hear from Americans on why they choose to serve, why they do not serve, what barriers might be preventing them from serving, and why they feel there is no need to serve. And for our meeting today, we will begin with the panel discussion with distinguished experts from the community who embody service, and then we want to hear from you, the public, and continue the conversation about pathways and employment in service and overall the Commission's work. And that reminds me, on your chairs, you have a little card that looks like this. So if you are too shy, don't get an opportunity, think about it later. Please write any comments you have on the card, and you can leave it for us, and we'll take it so that we will add it to the information that we are gathering from our meetings, both here and in other locations, but also on the web. And I don't know, so the other thing that I'm supposed to remind you all is, again, our social media contacts, so you can reach out to us on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, and our hashtag or our handle is @inspire2serveus. Or you can reach us on the web, and all the commissioners get all the public comments every month, and we read them all. So you can leave us a message or on our comment page at www.inspiretoserve.gov. So to kick off this evening, though, I'd like to introduce a very special guest, Lieutenant Governor Evelyn Sanguinetti. Lieutenant Governor Sanguinetti serves the residents of the state of Illinois as the 47th Lieutenant Governor. Her career in service in Illinois started with Evelyn joining the Illinois Attorney General Jim Ryan's office as the Assistant Attorney General, where she fought to protect the people of the state of Illinois. In 2010, Evelyn suffered an accident while walking on Wheaton City property, and subsequent medical evaluations revealed that she had multiple sclerosis. Evelyn vowed never to let her MS stop her, and she has proceeded to run for and win an election to the Wheaton City Council on a platform of delivering efficient and streamlined government. And as Lieutenant Governor in Illinois, Evelyn has applied that same passion to her role that has propelled her throughout her life, from her humble beginnings in Florida to becoming Illinois' first Latina Lieutenant Governor. And on that note, please join me in welcoming Lieutenant Governor Sanguinetti.
Thank you.
Yes. Hello. You know, I love to talk so much that I think I was only able to come up to like four of you out there today. And so it is my wish to be invited back and get to know all of you a little bit better. As it was stated before, I'm your Lieutenant Governor in the state of Illinois, and these are one of my favorite speeches to ever give in life, trying to let people know how they could become involved in so many different forms. And it's my wish to do this because clearly I'm not going to be around forever as Lieutenant Governor, and I see a lot of youngsters back there, and maybe with my talk with you today, I could convince you to become the next governor, the next Lieutenant Governor, the next councilman, the next district court judge, or whatever it may be, but it all begins with service. So I'd like to, first of all, thank a few members that made this all so possible today, because as you folks know, there's a lot of moving parts that it takes to put events like this together. I want to start with the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service for visiting Illinois. I'd like to thank Kennedy Keene College for hosting us tonight, and I'd also like to thank Commissioner and Vice Chair Deborah Wada. It's just such a pleasure to be here. So I am Latina by birth, and I talk really fast, so I'll try to take it really slow. But I wanted to know the sorts of things that motivated me to get involved in public service. And actually, I was asked this question by an attorney on your panel today. And I got to thinking, and really what motivated me to get involved with public service were my parents. And my experiences growing up. You see, my background is not a political background at all. As a matter of fact, I never thought to run for office ever. My mother was a refugee from Fidel Castro's Cuba. And my dad was an immigrant from Guayaquil, Ecuador. And they came to the United States so that they could live that American dream and in turn offer it to their children. So my parents get to a poor community because they're teenagers, and it's called Hialeah, and it's off of Miami, Florida. And they met, and I came shortly thereafter. Mom chose to have me and to keep me when she was only 15 years of age. And that painted my backdrop. And I'll tell you later why this formed me and later enabled me to really think about public service and how important it is in my life. You see, growing up in the sort of communities I grew up in Hialeah, Florida, I was disinterested and uninspired in my schools, and I felt like my schools were disinterested and uninspired with me. You see, since my parents came from another country, English was not my first language. I needed to learn English from Sesame Street and the Electric Company, and later I needed to come back to my home to become a child advocate for my parents, because my grandmother, my great-grandmother at home, as well as my parents, were dying for me to learn English so that I could read their mail, tell them about expiration dates, telling about foreclosures if that should be happening. So in these neighborhoods, I was destined to fail because the resources were not present, right? And so I did fail. Since I didn't know English, I failed the first grade. And yes, your Lieutenant Governor failed the first grade, but listen, I made it. So after failing the first grade, I did have a shiro in my house, and that was my mom. And she always told me, en este país tú vas a subir como la espuma. In this country, you could rise like the foam. And I believed her. And she bought me a piano to stay off the streets. And I also remember arguments between my parents growing up. We were always moving, always one step ahead of the landlord. And I'd hear those arguments at the dinner table. Are we going to move again, or are we going to put food on the table? It's a choice because we can't do both. So I believe that it was those experiences that later led me into leadership and to actually say, you know, this so marked me and at times hurt me. Maybe, just maybe, I could do something about it now as an adult. So going forward, you know, I did find that opportunity, and it was in the way of an educational opportunity. And that also marked me, too, because I felt disinterested and uninspired in my schools in times past, but all of a sudden, there was a special school in my community that said, if you have talent, it was a school of the arts, and if we let you in, we'll pay your first 2 years of college. We'll take care of all of that. And for me, that opened the doors of my life. Because sitting in those classrooms, I did become inspired and motivated with academics. But I also thought to myself, this must be what the rich kids get in the nice neighborhoods. And it always stuck with me. So much so that when I went and completed my four-year program on a scholarship because I was given an opportunity, then next, I went to Illinois, and I went to law school. Now, in law school, I learned so many things. First of all, I learned back when I went to law school, because I'm no spring chicken, that there were very few Latinos that were graduating from the law school. And that marked me, too, because a lot of times I felt, wow, do I really deserve to be here? Because there are so few of us. But in that capacity, I felt that in law school, I could start to serve. I could develop a group of Latino future lawyers, even though there were very few Latinos in my graduating class. I also found out about an opportunity in law school. You see, it was the 20th century. It was Chicago, Illinois. Yet people were still getting discriminated against on the basis of housing. You see, people were being denied housing because of the color of their skin, because of their sexual preference, because of how many children they had. All these things illegal under the Fair Housing Act. But I had an opportunity in the way of serving in the John Marshall Law School Fair Housing Legal Clinic. They said you could get a legal license. It's called 7-Eleven. Now it's pretty mandatory for all students in law school. You get that 7-Eleven license, and you represent people for free, and you make sure that they get that housing. Imagine how cool that is. Imagine an opportunity to serve in that capacity. I will just tell you, the first few people I spoke with, it was that mom. She was a single mom of three girls, and she was denied housing because the lender believed that she did not make enough. Yet she did. And our legal group sued the people that denied her housing, and she often told us during the intake process, where they open up their hearts to you and they let you know about all these hurtful things that they've been through. And she said, to me, it wasn't so much giving my three girls a house. To me, it was all about a swing set. Having that swing set in the back of the house lets me know that I made it, and for me, I felt that it would let my girls know that their mom made it. And think about how good that feels, to be able to do something like that for someone, and you know you're not going to get anything in return, but when you serve like that, let me tell you that all the money in the world cannot replace the sort of feeling you get when you make somebody feel that way. It just makes you feel good. So going forward, I was able to do that, and I loved, loved, loved serving. But then, you know, I needed to make shmoney, right? I needed to make money. You got that reference, right? Yeah, Cardi B is my best rapper, too. Yeah, I needed to make money. I got out of law school, chose Wheaton as the place to have kids. I thought to myself, I'm an attorney. Things are going so well, and then all of a sudden, life gives you that stop sign. And I had a fall on city property, and a doctor told me I have this disease that would consume me called multiple sclerosis. And I thought to myself, that's it. I've served in the past. Now I'm an attorney. I have kids. Everything going in life for me. Yet I get this diagnosis, and I was ready to check out. But I had an ally at home, this guy I met at law school, named Ray. And he told me, you either get busy living or you get busy dying. Because you have a choice. And right now, there's something going on in the city. There's an opening in the Wheaton City Council. And you could take everything you're feeling, all of this hurt, and turn it around and make it into something good, because it's what you've always believed in, and it's what makes you feel good. So I chose to live, and I chose to run for the Wheaton City Council. And it was there that I went door to door, and I told my neighbors about my philosophy about streamlined government and all the things I wanted to do in the city. And I won that election, and I feel it was because it really came from the heart. You know, they knew I was there for the right reasons. And then I got this opportunity to run for lieutenant governor, and I thought to myself, I have no skills in being a lieutenant governor whatsoever. I don't even know what lieutenant governors do. But later I found out that all lieutenant governors in life really never knew what lieutenant governors did. So, as my mom used to say, si no tú, entonces quién, right? If not you, then who? And I did it, even though I didn't have the political pedigree. But let me tell you, I have, and I had, the servant's heart. Because once elected, what do you think I was able to do? Well, I was able to get involved with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. And I was able to tell people that feel that they're on their way out, just like I felt at one point in time. I let them know that there is life, even with this debilitating disease. I was able to go back now as a servant in a higher capacity. I have the bully pulpit, so a lot of times when I speak, people listen. And it's so great, because remember all those stories that I told you about? My parents, you know, the necessity of food, moving around all the time. Well, I joined forces with the Commission to End Child Hunger and made it a big project of mine to make sure that all families knew that if you get free and reduced lunch during the school year, guess what? You have to get it in the summertime when your kids are exercising and they want to get out there and they want to play. You should know about these places, and I should find you more of these places all over the state of Illinois as your lieutenant governor. So at the end of the day, I love my job because I love to serve, and there's so many different ways to serve. And I'll close with that. You could serve in your church. You could serve, my kids love serving in the disabilities ministry. Well, guess what? When you do that, you're a leader. You're a leader. And you could serve in the PTA, and you could serve on city council, you could serve in the county, or you could serve the way I love to serve, which was simply going to retirement homes and playing My Way by Frank Sinatra for all the folks there. Because when you see them smile, then if you're a true servant, your belly is full. Thank you so much for having me today.
Before you go, we just want to present you a certificate, and thank you very much for coming this evening. We greatly appreciate your testimony. Thank you.
I did not expect it. I swear to you. Thank you. Well, let's take a picture with it.
Okay. So now I want to turn to my fellow commissioner, Mr. Alan Casey, to introduce our panelists and to moderate the discussion on distinct climate of service in Chicago and pathways to employment in service. Mr. Alan Casey is a social entrepreneur who has pioneered ways to empower citizens to make a difference. He is the founder and CEO of the Be the Change, Inc., which creates and manages national issue-based campaigns driven by broad cross-section coalitions. Mr. Casey is also the co-founder and former CEO of City Year, which unites young adults ages 17 to 24 from all backgrounds for an intensive year of full-time community service, mentoring, tutoring, and educating children. Mr. Casey.
Thank you, Deborah. Thank you for that kind introduction. It is, as Deborah mentioned, I co-founded the City Year program. We started in Boston, and we brought City Year to Chicago almost 25 years ago. It was one of the first cities we came to after Boston because there was such great civic commitment here. So I've been coming here for more than two decades. I love this city, and I'm so glad that we could spend this evening with you here tonight. As Deborah mentioned, the goal of our commission is to really look at these big issues and then make recommendations 2 years from now, in March of 2020, to the President, the Congress, and most importantly, the American people. So we are traveling the country, really going to all parts of the country, really to learn about what's happening at the local level, to get ideas from people, get your input. And so we're very excited to have a distinguished group of leaders with us tonight so we can hear their experience around service, and then we're going to open it up for conversation, comments, questions from all of you. So we are joined here by four great people. First, we have Monique Ellington, who is the Chicago Director of the Service Year Alliance, which is working to try to make a year of service an opportunity for all young people over the country. We have Leah Eggers, who is the Program Manager of Youth Workforce Development at Youth Guidance. She's also an AmeriCorps alum and a Peace Corps alum. So that's Leah. And we have Ruthie Moore sitting right to my right here, who is a contributor at WVON 1690 AM and has also had a great conversation with Ruthie. She's had a tremendous amount of experience working with young people. And finally, last but not least, we have Eli Williamson, who I know from previous work on veterans issues, who's the co-founder and board president of Leave No Veteran Behind. And additionally, we also have our fellow commissioners here, Ed Allard and Jeanette James, Avril Haynes, and Deborah, who you met, who's our vice chair. So I want to dive right in and get started. And I guess I'll start first. We'll start with Monique. So the first question I want to ask is, what, in your opinion, is the role of service in promoting civic responsibility and engagement? And do you have any recommendations for us as to how to leverage service to build civic engagement in Chicago and around the country?
Thank you so much, Alan. It's a pleasure to be here. I'll start off by saying that our organization is really focused on making service a common expectation and opportunity for all young Americans. And the way that I see that service can be help to promote civic engagement and responsibility in communities in particular is when you serve, you find a connection and purpose to your community and to yourself. It's one of the ways that we develop civically engaged leaders that are really invested in the issues that surround them, that impact them every day. So it's important that in that journey through service that they're learning who they are, what their purpose is, what they're called to do. And I'm a firm believer that purpose is what drives us. It is where our passion lies. It is where we often have full access to opportunities when we're connected to our purpose. So through service and giving back to your community, you see yourself as an agent that can change the present circumstances.
Terrific. Thank you. Leah, what would you add?
From your perspective and
so,
experience.
Similar to Monique.
Move the mic.
So I would say that I rarely speak to a young person who doesn't bring up something that they care about in their community, whether it's something that has to do with their family, has to do with their friends, it's an access to a resource, something that they want to see differently. And so certainly that's something when I was looking to what I wanted to do after college, service really called to me because I saw it as an opportunity to actually have an impact. And sometimes it can feel really overwhelming in looking at broad national issues, even sometimes at the city level. There's always challenges in our cities and communities, but really seeing service as a chance to actually have an impact, because what I certainly appreciated through my different service experiences and what I've seen here in Chicago with other great organizations is that it's really working alongside community and creating programs, creating interventions that are really a reflection of what's needed in that community. So it's not something that's top down, but it's really bottom up, and then it certainly did for me, but certainly gives other young people here in Chicago who do have access to service opportunities, like Monique said, an opportunity to see themselves, to explore a career area, to get to know other professionals, other youth in their community, other adults in their community, and feel really connected. And I think exposure is the biggest thing. Working with young people is like, if you don't see it, you don't know it. And so just getting a chance to feel that and also feel that support while they're serving can make the biggest difference.
Thank you. And Ruthie, what would you say about service promoting civic engagement and responsibility?
Anytime anybody starts off something with a quote, it's always like, But one of my favorite quotes regarding service is by Shirley Chisholm, and it is, "Service is the rent that we pay for the privilege of living on this earth. ellipses because I'm pretty sure there's much more that goes along with that. But one of the things that connects people together is a desire to serve. And so if we promote service, then civic engagement is a byproduct of service. And so integrating young people and all people into the social fabric, service is a really good way to make people feel connected. And once people are connected, that is how we can work together better to actually service everyone.
I love that quote, by the way.
Okay, I'll take a little bit different track. Everything that everyone said is absolutely correct. I'm a little bit lazier than that. Personally, I just find in this environment, an environment in which there's anger all over the place as to things, how things need to be changed, how things need to be fixed. And I found myself being angry and upset as a veteran, being in Afghanistan, hearing about how many children were dying on the south side of Chicago, south and west sides of Chicago, and how that number was larger than the amount of veterans we lost at wartime in 2007. And so I look at service a little bit differently in the sense that, you know, I think it is a way for you to figure out who you are, but I also think as we start to make criticisms, as we start to get angry, it's also a way to pacify your anger, right? It's the only place, service is the only place in which you have to find common cause. It's the only place in which you have to find solutions with people you don't necessarily want to engage with. And so it is a great mediator of dispute, right, when you actually have to commit to fixing a problem. And so I get the high-level part, right, and as a veteran of both Iraq and Afghanistan, I understand service, I understand all the common bonds, I understand who you are. But I also think that it can mitigate many of the types of social issues that we have globally, and I use that term from a national standpoint with all that rage and anger that people have right now. No one is talking about what they can actually do with the people that they may be angry with. And I think that service allows for that. I think the service pacifies those bigger problems. And personally, I think it allows people to move beyond just the problems to the things they actually enjoy.
Thank you, Eli, and I really love your passion and commitment after serving in Iraq and Afghanistan to come home to work on issues here, right at home, and really leads me to my next question. So, and I'm going to start with you on this one because of what you said. The commission has recently defined service as, quote, a personal commitment of time, energy, and talent to a mission that contributes to the public good by protecting the nation and its citizens, strengthening communities, or promoting the general social welfare. So you came home to work on issues in the South Side. What are some, and this is for all of you, but I want to start with you, Eli. What are some community needs specific to South Side Chicago, and what service efforts that you've seen are most successfully meeting those needs?
That's a great question. I think one of the largest issues that we face here in Chicago, and we've got a tremendous amount of civic engagement, we have a tremendous amount of leadership programs, but there are very few opportunities to listen to those who actually have the solutions. Now, I know everyone in this room has done phenomenal work, right? Everyone in this room is motivated, which is why you're here on a really nice day in Chicago to come talk about service, right? But our ability to listen to those who are closest to the problem and our ability to understand how they view the problem themselves is the only way you can actually solve the issues. And so thank you. So I think that when we talk about the issues of Chicago, when we talk about the issues and the problems that we face here, a lot of it is this very one-sided conversation, right? People analyzing what's going wrong and not really hooking into those who are creating solutions every day at the ground level. Now, the reason that I bring that up is if we're talking about national service, the individuals that are serving should look like the people who face the problem as well. The representation for those who are in AmeriCorps should look like the communities in which they're serving. So there shouldn't be a mass, you know, entry of a bunch of different people who are coming into communities. It should be outflowing, right? Right now there is a epidemic of opiates. The South Side and the West Side of Chicago have been dealing with a quote-unquote opiate epidemic for quite some time. There are people in this community that truly understand what it takes to move someone from being addicted to a substance into a sustainable lifestyle. I have yet to hear anyone nationally or locally say we need to tap into that knowledge here in Chicago. We need to fund those types of individuals to make sure that after the 80s and the 90s of dealing with these issues, that these are the national spokespeople and they're the ones that we tap into because they have the knowledge. So when we talk about the problems of service, it's all about representation. And if the people who are most impacted are not represented on the at the highest levels and to the lowest levels, then those problems will still maintain and exist.
Yes, we should. Thank you, Eli. I think there's a lot of wisdom in what you said. It reminds me, my good friend Brian Stevenson, who's a national hero, who wrote this great book, Just Mercy, I highly recommend, talks about the importance of proximity and really getting close. And we had a great meeting earlier today with some young people from the south side of Chicago who made basically the same point to us. So thank you. Ruthie, what would you share about needs in the south side of Chicago and what service can do to help address those needs?
Okay. In terms of what are some of the specific needs, I would like to say violence is one of the starting points in terms of what are some of the needs. So from violence, we have things like post-traumatic stress disorder, which is mental health-based. Violence also cuts into economics. Which comes first? You know, who knows? But some of the better programs are ones that are sort of supporting school systems where schools have pitfalls. So in terms of the lack of whatever young people are getting from schools, a lot of service organizations, mentor organizations, after school programs are filling that void. And so those are some of the most successful ways that I see service playing into solving what is plaguing some of the black and brown communities in Chicago.
Thank you. Leah, you've recently started an AmeriCorps program working with young people in schools, and you also do workforce development. What, from your perspective, are needs in the south side of Chicago and what service can do?
All right, thank you. Yeah, so at the organization I work at called Youth Guidance, I oversee our youth workforce development programming, so helping high school students, recent high school graduates, get connected to career opportunities. And through that, for the last 3 years, we've had an AmeriCorps service program, and from the beginning, we were committed to having opportunity youth be our service members, because certainly, when you look at national service, and particularly probably in AmeriCorps, you see a lot of people who look like me. And a lot of people who look like me had certain privileges to be able to access service opportunities because I had other supports in my life. I had a mentor or family members who guided me towards that. And what we've definitely seen with some of our young people is that they certainly have plenty of wonderful skills and aspirations. They have the knowledge of their community. They want to make a difference, but that they need that support along the way. And so it's getting that additional access to other funds, childcare, transportation, because a lot of the service opportunities in the city of Chicago, while some are based in communities, so one of our service programs where we had two AmeriCorps members this year was at Parker, which is elementary, just not far from here. So we were trying to place our members in communities where they were coming from, but also some other service programs, you know, they're having to travel across town, and you know, there's a lot of challenges that young people may need to deal with in order to access that. And so I would say that the biggest thing that we've tried to do is to help meet the needs is really just be understanding and provide that guidance and mentorship that they need and not give up on them because one thing comes up that they're a challenge that they're encountering, because we treat it as a youth development program. And I think more service opportunities can certainly be aspirational and working towards that as well, because we have plenty of young people. When you look at, you know, who's showing up to rally in Chicago, there's a lot of young voices and a lot of amazing young people here, and we should be able to connect them to service opportunities, because then they can get access to an education award, get access to a whole network of alumni, employers, and things like that.
Thank you. Monique, you've done a lot of work in the South Side through Green Corps and now with Service Year Alliance, getting Vistas in Englewood, et cetera, and I know you've worked on a whole strategy. From your perspective, what are the needs here, and what can service do to address those needs?
I certainly echo a lot of what has already been said, but I think some of the things is the fact that there is a lack of opportunity and lack of awareness of the opportunities that actually exist. Coupled with that, I would say, is that you have a lot of service programs that are working in silos or programs that work in silos that don't know how to collaborate. And collaboration is something that has to be taught. And there needs to be a collective impact approach to really support young people. No one program is going to be able to do it. No one individual is going to be able to do it. So it has to be a community effort of really embracing the entire community and all that exists around a particular young person. The other thing I'll offer in that is that sometimes we look at young people and we think of them as all the same. Same issues, same challenges, same concerns. Where we understand that opportunity youth in particular are really a homogenous group, are not a homogenous group of people with different sets of experiences, different assets that they bring to the table. And I think the other part of that is we need to try to work together to have some systemic framework exists within communities, and that cannot happen. I'm going back to what Eli said earlier. It has to happen with the people at the table, the young people at the table, influencing what they think will work out best. And the more we work and talk with them and uncover what is it that you want to do, going back to what I said earlier about purpose, what is it that you want to do, and not me just throwing you into something and saying, I hope that works out for you, and patting you on the back, but really working with them together to figure out what are their goals, how can we better support them, how can we leverage partnerships, how can we work more closely together without just thinking about, oh, you're one organization that's doing it, this is another organization. Navigating the city of Chicago as a young person is one of the most challenging things. If I have to go here to get support from this thing and they have one process, then I go to another place and they have a different process. We need to have partnerships, but we know what they're going to experience when they go into an aid office or get support. Like, what does that look like for them? How do we help them to navigate that? And having these warm transfers, where we're transferring you over so that they're supported and they feel that they are of value to the community is the biggest thing I would say.
Thank you so much. That's yes, we should. You know, as we've been traveling around the country, we've been meeting with young people everywhere we go, and I think my fellow commissioners would agree, it's always the best sessions we have. We learn the most, we get educated, and you're absolutely right. They have to be at the table helping to design these efforts so that they really do meet community needs. As I said, we met with some great young people today, and one of the issues facing young people here in Chicago and around the country are barriers to employment. So what are some of the barriers that you see to employment for young people in Chicago, and how are they similar or different from the barriers to opportunities for service? Why don't we start with you, Ruthie, for this one?
Okay. I remember first seeing the term opportunity youth a few years ago, and I thought it was a joke because I said, but these are youth that lack opportunity. Why are we calling them opportunity youth? And I started getting serious about opportunity youth when I saw the government funding models, because everybody had money for opportunity youth. And so, of course, nonprofits sort of follow funding tracks. And so a lot of nonprofits started paying attention to opportunity youth. And one of the biggest barriers that I see is job readiness. People oftentimes say that there's a lack of jobs. In my professional opinion, there are many jobs. There are just people who are not able to fulfill those jobs. So how do we get young people or opportunity youth ready for jobs? I think service could be a very good way. That's actually the answer to one of my questions. So I'll repeat it again when the time comes up. But I think service, like an actual sustained service program, is a great way to teach job readiness skills. More specifically, social emotional learning skills. Again, social emotional learning skills are what a lot of opportunity youth are lacking. Opportunity youth are also disproportionately youth of color. And so how do we get these opportunity youth back engaged in society? And I think service, a service component coupled with job readiness, would be an innovative way to achieve that goal of lessening the gap between opportunity and no opportunity.
Yes, I think that's excellent, and I'm really glad you said that and jumped ahead. And I just want to say, because I know some of the folks who are involved in redefining the term, so we used to refer to some young people as at risk or disadvantaged, and people thought, well, that's a deficit model. That's labeling. That's saying to them, you're not And so the flip was their opportunity youth, the idea being they're an opportunity waiting to be blossomed. And I'll tell you, the young people we met with today, and you're absolutely right, they all got involved in service programs, and they are extraordinary leaders. One of my fellow commissioners, Avril, said she'd work for any of them, and we all agreed. So I think your point about service as a connection to employment is really well spoken. Leah, what would you add in terms of barriers to employment and also barriers to service?
So I definitely, as someone who runs different models of job readiness training programs, I certainly agree with that and in preparing our young people. I would also, I still think that there is more for the business community to do. Certainly there are jobs out there, but they are not necessarily jobs that are created and meant for young people, because the expectations are you come in on time, and we're trying to create environments where our young people really have to lose part of who they are. And so especially if they're going into corporate environments and cultures that may not be understanding to who they are and where they came from. And so I think the business community needs to can do more in Chicago, and I've seen a lot of great mobilization over the last couple of years through our 100K hiring fairs that have happened around the city, really different employers who are stepping up and saying, we're committed to hiring opportunity youth, and we know that that might involve changing up what we do in terms of preparation and training. So, you know, adding different training components and onboarding employees, potentially offering opportunities for educational advancement, but then also just having trained supervisors and mentorship in the workplace. So I've seen really great progress happen in Chicago and nationally, but I think there is still work to be done on the business side of things to really make a change in the workplace and what work looks like. And I think service is a great opportunity for youth to generally get training, support, identity development while they're in generally a supportive environment, but then how we're positioning them, helping them for when they're transitioning into maybe more of a corporate environment, maybe not necessarily that, but a full-time employment opportunity, and that they're ready for those expectations, but also employers are ready to like really receive our excellent young people.
Fabulous. Monique, what would you add from your perspective?
So once again, I'm echoing a lot of what has been said, but I will say this. I think you're right in saying that there are opportunities, but there's a huge skills gap, right, where young people need to be developed within a program with the credentials that they need to be connected to employment opportunities. I've seen some outstanding programs such as one in Baltimore Civic Corps, Civic Works, where they are engaging employers from the very beginning of the program, and they're helping to select the candidates that will go through the service and offering mentorship and training and internship opportunities throughout the service experience. So when that young person is done, they're 100% placement in those programs. And a lot of times there is a separation between when you do your year of service and what happens after that. We have to develop young people while they're in the program with interpersonal skills, the right types of, we have to actually make sure that they are connected to a career and not just exploration but immersion. To be honest, a lot of young people have not seen other careers besides a police officer, a doctor, a teacher. So they don't know that I can be a part of public service. I can take a service. I can be a part of a service model. What does that really look like for me? They can't be what they can't see. So if we don't expose them to these pathways, they're not going to know about them. So the more that we can connect young people within a program to careers, giving them the credentials that they need, hopefully helping them to have college credit, the more they can advance and see their path of success.
Thank you. I think that's an excellent point, and it's a great recommendation for us as we try to gather ideas of making a better connection. I mean, starting with what you said, Ruthie, between service as a pathway to employment. And I think there is a lot of interest in the business community to engage, but to get them involved at the beginning and not just wait to, oh, the young person's graduating from the program in 2 weeks, what are we going to do? And think, and we've also seen that there is a lot of skills development through these service programs. Eli, from your perspective and your experience, what would you say about barriers to employment, service, and the connection?
Oh, absolutely. I think everyone has said some really great things. Well, I want to refer to a comment that was made before about mental and behavioral health. We talk about our youth. As a veteran, we have a robust engagement around veterans' mental and behavioral health after conflict and warfare. It was mentioned before about how many of these youth suffer from many of the same issues because they have seen violence. They live in, and they have witnessed violence, and violence has actually happened to them. And so I think one of the things we can't let up on is making sure that we're much more proactive as we articulate mental health, especially in African American community. It's not something that I think we're just now grappling with in a constructive and proactive way. And so as we talk about putting youth into employment opportunities, putting youth into opportunities for long-term training, making sure that they are in a good place before they get there. You know, when we see these mass shootings, one of the big things that happens afterwards is they talk about putting in all these counselors into schools to make sure everyone is fine. How many of these youth get that same level of care? And then we're asking them to go into a business environment, right? So if we are part of a mass shooting exercise right here, how quickly do we go back to work, right? How much does that impact our family life? And so we have to really be able to look at and drill down with these youth some of those issues that prevent them from being able to show up for work, that prevent them from having some of the soft skills because they're dealing with these types of incidents every day. And so I think that we have to be very clear that if we're talking about opportunity youth, and I understand the term, we also have to understand what these youth have actually gone through just to show up at your door to do some of these programs, just to show up to say, you know what, I'm ready to do something other than what I've just witnessed and seen.
Thank you. In addition to young people being developed, from your experience, how are service opportunities improving the community and also business development in Chicago, and particularly in the South Side? I guess I'll start with Monique on this one.
Sure. So I'll just say that I think that being a part of a service program allows you an opportunity to really develop your skills and helps you to explore what the next step is. So for some young people, they decide, I want to develop myself in business or in entrepreneurial skills and really connecting. One of the programs that we have right here in Englewood is the VISTA program that is called the Legacy Project with Greater Englewood Community Development Corporation. And, of course, the Community Development Corporation already has a number of different opportunities. They're enhancing business. They're a small business development accelerator and working with local businesses to connect them to successful pathways. I think if we can continue to have programs that have members participating in business, engaging with young people to show them the ropes, per se, about what it takes to really establish your business. Young people have tons of different fabulous ideas that have not been cultivated or they've not explored or had even any conversations around how do I develop this model, what does this look like. To be able to connect with an accelerator program or the CDC to really begin to talk through those strategies, I think is a really important thing. The other thing I'll say is that it's going a little bit back to what Leia said about how do we engage more of the corporations to be a part as mentors in helping to develop professional development framework for programs? How do we ensure that, how about we start from the end result of looking at the businesses and what they need and then developing programs based on what's needed, right? And then have on a cross between who should be connected to that type of program. So I think it really is thinking about how a business can impact a community and thus how the young person within the community is impacted by the business. This should be a collective strategy, but a lot of times everything is so siloed out that there are not clear connections to pathways for business and business opportunities.
That's great. Thank you. Eli, what would you say in terms of service being
First things first, I want to give a shout out to Monique. She, you know, when she started working in Chicago, one of the biggest issues for non-for-profits like ours is sheer capacity. So when they brought the VISTA program here into Englewood and to other places, it has a robust impact on our ability to serve the individuals that we work with. A quick background on our organization, we do transitional work for veterans. We do transitional work for community members and youth. And so over the last 9 years, we provide over 1,000 transitional jobs to veterans, youth, and community members. So for all intents and purposes, we are a business. The difference is that we go out and we find these individuals that people don't necessarily want to hire or that need to be economically stabilized. Now, what's most important about programs like ours that are transitional in nature is that we have a long-term partner that focuses on long-term employment. So the areas in which we focus security, we focus risk management, We also have a partnership with a general contracting firm for people going into construction management. And so when we talk about what pipelines you actually can provide for youth going into work, you have to be able to design a pipeline that makes sense for the employer. You know, as a business person, I don't believe in charity because charity puts you out of business. But Monique just brought up the fact that even though you're a business owner, you can have an impact, a positive, constructive social impact in your environment. So you start to break down what is that business case when I spend the time to train up individuals who live right next door to where I'm working. What is the business case when I decide to make a major investment in this community, which no one is making an investment? What type of loyalty am I getting from my workers, right? What type of social services now am I partnered with to make sure that people have the needs, that their needs taken care of so they show up? So I think that personally there's a case to be made as a business and as a business community to look at these demographics that normally have been overlooked because they may be coming with some attributes that other demographics don't have, right? So I'll end with this. You know, we've provided a lot of transitional jobs. When we send them on to our security and to our other risk management opportunities, they talk about how much we've invested in them and how excited they are to have somebody else invest as well. And those employees end up staying much longer. So if we look at the workforce right now, we look at how employees are traveling from job to job, and what that's doing and what that's costing businesses. So I think that we have to be on the business case side of things, and I think as we think creatively, that case, you know, makes sense for itself.
Thank you, Eli. I want to ask, we have a couple more I want to get through before we open it up. The next one I want to ask, and I'll start with you, Leah, is you've had a lot of experience in service. You're involved in the community here. From your perspective, what are some of the key characteristics to make a service program really outstanding?
So I think it's more so combining a lot of the things that were already brought up here today. So I think it's not only, I think in order to make a program work, it would have to leverage the public dollars that are available to make a service program happen, like those that come from the Corporation for National Community Service, but also pairing that with other dollars, whether it's coming from the state or local government, or pairing that with investment from foundations or the philanthropic community, because what we've done in our organization, in order to provide job training, to provide that mentorship and support, we've had to combine our service year program with our job readiness training program. That comes with separate dollars, because right now, the way our funding streams are set up for our service year, it doesn't allow us that flexibility to have the staffing that we really need to support that service opportunity, to really, you know, provide the members with that person who's going out into the community with them, to coach them on the job, to provide that supervision and support. And so really building out a more robust funding stream to support service opportunities is really something that I see as being a huge need and something to make it more comprehensive. But also then, what does that follow-up support look like? You know, you do a service year opportunity for 10 to 12 months. Something we know about opportunity youth is a lot of times they need support for up to probably 3 years, because life happens, and especially for opportunity youth, there's a lot of challenges and things that happen that might change their path from where they were going, and someone to go back to who's going to take them back into that, maybe not to redo the job training program, but someone who's going to be that person to guide them into what's next. And the ability to have someone who can provide that career advancement support to them. Okay, now I'm going to actually help you apply to school, because now that you've done this service year opportunity, you're really excited about continuing your education, or you really want to go into a trade now that you've been doing a service opportunity like Green Corps and want to get additional credentialing and training, or that you want to actually go into a different type of like direct workforce experience. And so I think the biggest thing comes down to, and I think this is just kind of the nature of working in nonprofits and the public space, is there's always a need for more dollars and capacity building. I think our like wonderful, you know, folks on this panel who are doing great work in organizations can say, like, there are innovative ideas, and our young people also bring plenty of innovative ideas with us, but knowing that you're going to have funding and support for a longer period of time, that it's going to last beyond just that kind of service term, can make all the difference in really doing something transformational.
Thank you. Thank you. Ruthie, what would you add in terms of what makes for an outstanding service program?
Funding. I definitely agree that it's funding, but I sort of just wanted to add to the narrative that oftentimes a lot of programs have one or two models, and it's either let me take you out of your community and show you this lovely, flashy downtown area, or it's let me come into your community and fix it. And so I think that some of the best models for programming are ones that are community-based. And so if you live on the South Side, you can, too, work on the South Side. But in terms of business development, what does that look like, and what role does violence play in the lack of business development? So there are a few root causes that we have to get to before I think we can actually create sustainable, like, program models. But to answer your question more specifically, again, it's funding. You have to be able to fund these programs. I mean, pay the people that are working them, or pay the young people that are in the programs. I think funding is the key to sustain service. And I know that when in terms of service, you think, oh, that should be free. But as we can see, things that are left, you know, then it becomes a voluntary thing. So I think that funding is certainly like the pivotal thing that is missing. But not just funding, sustained funding, because funding comes in cycles. And once the cycle is over, you have to kind of hitch your wagon to the next thing. So what is a sustained, fundable model that the young people can and the workers can basically, you know, be happy? And I think a lot of that is honestly just basic funding economics.
Thank you. Thank you. So I want to pivot for a minute. As Deborah said, we have a dual mandate. One is to look at how do we inspire more opportunities for people to serve, particularly young people who want to serve our country. Another is to look at the selective service system. So the selective service system is what we have in as a way to build a database and a registration in case the country needs to move to a draft. And right now, young men have to register when they turn 18, but women don't. So we're really looking at two things. One is, do we still need a selective service system? And the second is, if we're going to have it, should women have to register alongside men now that the Pentagon's lifted the ban on women in combat? Now, I know we only have one veteran here, but I'm also interested in everybody's perspective, because this is something ultimately we're going to make a recommendation on. We want the views of everyone in the country, and ultimately Congress and the President will decide on this. But so I'm going to come to the veteran last, actually, on this one. So, Monique, do you have a perspective on selective service and whether we should keep it? And if we do, should women register along with men?
I feel like I'm a little in a go-between a little bit. but I will say this. If we were to keep the selective service, then I think it's something that women should have to do as well. But what I will say is I would like to be in a country where people don't have to feel forced to serve, whether that is military service, national service, or public service, that they really have a desire to serve. And the more that we can build that out and that people can see themselves changing in communities and contributing to the American society, I think that, so I'm a little cross, I'm a little go-between, but if we're gonna be fair, and I want women to be able to have the same, okay?
Leah?
I would say I agree with the points that Monique made. You know, I'm not as well informed on probably the pros and cons of deciding whether or not to continue with selective service. But like Monique said, you know, if it is continued to open it up for females and just continue to encourage and grow national service in our country as something that people are really inspired and motivated to do.
Ruthie, your view?
Okay. Well, I thought about this question, and I know that combat positions are now open to women. So that is really cool. I don't think women should have to register for the draft. That's just my opinion. thank you for that. I know that's not a popular one. And mostly because I think military service should be voluntary. I want people who want to be there fighting for our country. And America, you know, we have the greatest military, and that is through I'm going to do the air quotes for voluntary, because a lot of people who join the military, oftentimes they might be an opportunity youth that don't have another option. And so in terms of voluntary, I don't think women should have to register.
Thank you. And Eli, I didn't get a chance, so as you wrap up, I'd like your view on Selective Service and whether we should keep it. I mean, you've served yourself in the military, and whether if we do keep it, you wouldn't register. But I also love you to add some closing thoughts on service and veterans, both what can service do to help? I mean, you're leading Leave No Veteran Behind. What can service do to support veterans coming home? And also, what about veterans continuing? Because I know you've also been involved in efforts for veterans to continue to serve, as you are, when they come back home. If you could just share your thoughts on that, along with Selective Service, as we wrap up.
All right. So I have the great honor to be prolific, right? It's what I'm hearing. Probably will fail at this. I'll talk a little bit personally about Selective Service. How many women in here have children? And so quite a few. And keep your hand up. And if your child is under threat, how many of y'all will risk your lives to make sure that your child is no longer under threat, right? To include give up your life potentially. How many would be willing to do that? Women who have children in here. All right, so I've always believed that everybody fights, right? So when it comes to Selective Service, I've never understood the concept that only men would be signing up for something that anyone would do for their child, right? That's a personal belief. Now, on the other side of that, I think one of the problems with the all-volunteer military is that it's become too easy to go to war. And so, and I'm not into drafting people right now, but because we have an all-volunteer military, because we have one of the best, if not the best, military in the world that can project power, right? The average citizen doesn't really know that we have our military in so many different countries right now, and they don't really understand just how much military families are impacted because we're a volunteer military. They don't understand what it's like to do deployment after deployment after deployment, because now we're at a point where only 1%, if less than 1% of our country actually serves in the military. So I understand some of these arguments, but as a veteran who's seen both been in Iraq and Afghanistan, who's seen people killed, destroyed, bodies mutilated, I think that our current populace is not a very good citizenry as it pertains to the military, because ultimately people don't understand the cost of having an all-volunteer force, which lends us as a nation to project our will in a wide variety of places, of which the citizenry has no idea where our military is even at today, and no idea what that costs for our families. So I understand the concept, but I would just push back a little bit by saying, you know, I'm kind of dissatisfied as a veteran with how little folks know about what it means to serve nowadays in the military as an all-volunteer force. And the reason that they know so little is because they never have to worry about it. So I'm a proponent of everybody signing up, because I think that's the first gut check as to whether or not we're going to utilize our military in a way that's effective, or we're going to use our military in a way that's arbitrary. Prolific statements on continued service for military personnel. I'm a contrarian, if you haven't figured it out. I believe that the only difference between a person who served in the military and a civilian is that we've been trained to a certain standard, a certain expectation of ethics, morality, around a very specific goal. And I think that there's an opportunity to leverage veterans because of that expectation of training and that expectation of ethics, morality in their communities. My biggest fear as a veteran is that, you know, you come back and you get older. I'm getting older now, and you're no longer a tough guy. And they only take you off the shelf for Memorial Day and Veterans Day to honor you for your service. I think we've got a lot of fight left in us. I think we've learned a lot. And I think we also have a lot to learn. The one thing that I really appreciate about civilians is their ability to build consensus with no overarching goal. And so I think that veterans can provide a lens in which the community can utilize, and I would hope that we can still be utilizing to solve many of our problems that we're facing today.
Thank you very much. Can we please, big round of applause for him. This was an extraordinary discussion, really thoughtful. Now we're going to pivot. You've all listened. This has been great. And I think when we've been taking notes, and you had a lot of excellent ideas for us to consider as we put our recommendations together. But now we want to open it up to you all. You've all listened very patiently, and this is now the public comment period, so we're open to anyone who wants to make a comment or ask a question. We'd like you to try to limit it to 2 minutes so that everybody gets a chance to talk. We'd like you to keep your comments focused on the mandate of the commission, please. And we have staff who will go around with microphones. And also, if in addition to any public comments, if you want to write something down and share it with us, we have these comment cards. We also have a website, www.inspiredtoserve.gov, and those can be submitted with your name or anonymously if you want. So, okay, we already have people up.
Yep, you call
start
them.
Here with, right here, Scott. Okay, we'll go here first, then to Scott. Okay. And if you could just say your name and where you're from.
Sorry about that.
Hi there. My name is Ivy Chikansky. I'm a Chicagoan, and I am sure you all spoke with such heart. It was very, very rewarding to hear all of your stories. But one thing that I find missing from this conversation that needs to be there is the public service sector employment, the public service jobs that past generations could count on. That includes healthcare workers, teachers, social workers, and transit workers. All of these have been decimated in our generation. These are the jobs that our parents' generation, our grandparents' generation could rely on, and to trade that in for the concept of service, just it doesn't compute. What Americans are looking for is good, stable jobs, and a way to get us there would be to invest more in the public sector workforce, hiring teachers to inspire those youth that you all care so much about, and you know, the workforce is what we need. As for the military, there are people that want to serve in the military that have been barred. Allow gays and lesbians to serve in the military. Allow transgender people to serve in the military. I think that is a question that should come first before forced service can be. I would urge you guys to make those proposals, as well as funding for higher education. We're here in this community college. This community college was founded to give those youth in this Englewood community the opportunities that you guys are talking about. It shouldn't be coming from nonprofits that you struggle for funding in those nonprofits. This community college is one of the institutions where this training and mentorship should be found, and we need for the government to restore funding for public service workers and public service education. So I'm hoping that you will bring those in your recommendations, and thank you so much for your care and your concern.
Thank you. Thank you for your comment. As Deborah mentioned, and actually our mandate is to look at public service as well and people serving in local, state, and federal government and what we can do to encourage more people to do that and support them. So I appreciate it. Tonight was more of this, and we're looking at different issues as we travel around the country. We were in Iowa just yesterday, met with a group of government employees to get their ideas. So tonight was a more focus on youth and opportunity youth, but your comments are well stated. Yes, right here, Scott.
Good evening, I'm Scott McFarland. I'm the Executive Director for Serve Illinois, which is the state's Commission on Volunteerism and Community Service. I also am a board member for the Association of America's State Service Commissions, which represents 53 state commissions around the country, so I want to speak on behalf of both of them. First, I want to thank you for using Illinois as a host for your meeting. I appreciate it greatly. Many of the folks in the room and many of the folks on the panel have a national service connection. We're very proud of that. I want to highlight two programs outside of Chicago, because we've heard a lot about Chicago. In terms of opportunity youth, we just launched a program with the city of Peoria last year. It's called Peoria Corps. And the idea behind that is Peoria is looking to revitalize their infrastructure and have a green infrastructure. And what they decided to do was they're taking youth, 18 to 25, having them be AmeriCorps members, working to work on that infrastructure, the beautification of the city, working on the storm drains and everything else to make the infrastructure stronger for Peoria. And the process, they're learning the skills so when they want to go work for the city as an employee in public service, they are going to get a streamline into that service. So it's an amazing partnership with the city of Peoria we have. Another one, which is a longer partnership we've had, is with Western Illinois University and Illinois State University. They have the Peace Corps Fellows Program, where Peace Corps members who have already done their service through Peace Corps are coming back, they're earning their master's degree through WIU or ISU, and they're also being AmeriCorps members at the very same time, working to promote rural development around our state. So you have these folks who have already given a year or 18 months of service in Peace Corps, and then they're doing another 2 years as AmeriCorps members. So that's an amazing piece. In total, the work that AmeriCorps State does for Illinois constitutes an $87 million investment into our state every single year. And for those who question if national service makes a lot of sense, if national service is worth it, for every one federal dollar put into Illinois through our program, we return the investment $4. For every one local dollar put into a program with AmeriCorps, the return on investment is $5.30. Finally, with that, AmeriCorps is a force multiplier. We require every single one of our AmeriCorps programs to recruit additional traditional volunteers that are not National Service volunteers. Our 1,600 AmeriCorps members last year recruited 18,000 additional volunteers to serve alongside them. So we're pretty proud of our National Service. Because I'm the policy chair of ASC, I have to give you some policy recommendations. So here we go. First off, we need more opportunities for folks to serve. In the Serve America Act, it said that we would have 250,000 AmeriCorps slots by 2017. It's now 2018. We have less than 100,000. We have subgrantee applications that come to my office every single year that we deny. We have applicants that go to all of our AmeriCorps programs that we turn down because there's not enough slots to fill. There is a demand. We need to fill that demand with more production for the AmeriCorps. We need to increase the education award for AmeriCorps members. There is no reason why 1 year of service cannot equal 1 year of college. And it's not that far off. I mentioned this earlier. The education award is $6,000. Average cost of this in-state tuition for 1 year is about $10,000. We're close. Let's make it one for one, if not more. Allow the Ed Award to be fully transferable. As we've mentioned earlier, those who are over 55 may transfer their education award to a child, grandchild, or foster child. Why cannot an older brother or sister transfer their education award to a younger brother or sister who wants to go to college? Eliminate the education award income tax. If you use your education award, it counts against you on your taxes. And the folks don't know that until they actually spend it. So they may get hit 7 years later with a tax bill. A couple more, real quick. I get calls every single day from areas that are in desperate need of national service. The problem is the way the system is set up now is a commission must subgrant out to a program. There is no way for a commission to place one member in Metropolis, Illinois, or Cairo, Illinois, which is in desperate need. So I love my subgrantees. I love working with them. But if we had the ability at the commission level to place individual members in our most needy communities around our state, you would cover the entire country. Right now, I cover 72 counties with my subgrantees. I want to cover 102. Allowing commissions to actually administer AmeriCorps programs would do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We could go back over here.
Ma'am?
Sure. Sure. Go. How about you're standing up? Why don't we go to you, and then we'll go to him.
Okay. My name is Georgina Johnson. I work for the Federal Aviation Administration, and I am the president of Great Lakes National Black Coalition. And we have launched a nine-month program here in the Englewood where we believe a child can be what a child can see. So you have black and brown air traffic controllers, pilots, engineers, NASA, anybody you name, we bring them to the table. What we're running into is that the community is not motivated. So we have this real big aviation day we're doing at Midway. We've never done it at Midway before in August. Today we only have 50 students. We have a slot of 200 because we believe in changing the mindset of a child. Because a lot of us grew up in the south side of Chicago, and the difference was that we were motivated to get out and to make a difference. We're running into the youth. They start strong, but they aren't motivated. So we're trying to instill love and give back and do the things that we grew up with a grandmother and grandfather when our mother and father was lacking. And we're running into, they're just not motivated. The kids are not coming. And we're making them punks because we're using an excuse about the environment and the violence. I go to D.C. once a month. Baltimore is facing the same issues. The difference is they have a community. We have the funding, but they have a community that's willing to get the kids there and help them along the way. We work with Boeing. We partner with Boeing. We partner with Southwest. We have the funding to make it happen. We just don't have the people.
Thank you. I'm reminded of what Monique kept repeating, which I think is so on target, about collective impact and working together. And I think, Monique, if you'd be willing to talk to... I'm sorry, what was your name again? Because she has great connections here, especially with service programs, and they can maybe get the word out, because that's a great opportunity that we should not let pass by.
Thank you. Everything is voluntary and everything is free.
That's terrific. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's keep going. You can say your name, please.
I'll get to that in just a sec. First, I'd just like to say, wow, 2 minutes. It's hard to really believe that you seriously want public input with that type of limitation. I have prepared 7 pages of testimony, which I will not deliver to now, but I have chopped it down to less than a page. I've timed it. It takes about 3.5 minutes, so I will read that statement now. My name is Dan Rutt. I have traveled from Toledo, Ohio, about 250 miles away, to be here today. I am one of the select few prosecuted and imprisoned for refusing to register for the draft back in the 1980s. We are here today for one reason and one reason alone. Congress punted on the politically unpopular choices of just ending draft registration or expanding it to women. Congress punted by appointing a commission to provide recommendations regarding draft registration a couple of years down the road. Unfortunately, this commission's work is so couched in generic service rhetoric that is hamstrung in dealing straightforwardly with the singular issue that triggered its creation, draft registration. Until the commission owns up to honestly and openly addressing the issue of draft registration as its core reason for existing, the commission will be a failure. Draft registration continues to have no mechanism to accommodate conscientious objection. Draft registration is fraught with noncompliance by young men either not registering at all, registering late, or not updating their addresses. The military cites no scenarios where they would want to draft. This is no time to expand registration, whether to women or persons with select skills the military might want. Now is the time to end draft registration. Voluntary service is true service. Let's keep it that way. Today's public meeting in particular highlights the failing credibility of the commission. Previous public meetings around the country have had very limited opportunity for open testimony from the general public. Today's meeting has even less opportunity. Previous public meetings have been billed as having opportunities to speak directly to the commission, and when people get there, they find that they're scheduled 2 minutes per citizen. This meeting is being billed as an opportunity for Q&A, not even to the commission, but to their invited speakers. Furthermore, the overall time that the public is to even participate in this insular Q&A has been cut down to, quote, 20 or 30 minutes. From the experience of previous public meetings, the chasm between the nature of invited testimony and uninvited testimony betrays a characterization of the commission's work to date as democratic. The commission is moving in the wrong direction. A responsive democratic process would have began with generous opportunities for open public testimony and then used this input to shape additional invited testimony as needed. This may already be too late to remedy. Unfortunately, the commission has other credibility problems that may very well make their job impossible. The commission is dominated by members from the military or traditional national security apparatus, all the while trying to couch their work in a broader, more generic view of service. This commission is pretty white in a nation where people of color are about 4 of 10 Americans. This commission is poorly designed to represent America. To make matters worse, the commission has chosen to conduct its business in such a manner that citizens have had to make Freedom of Information Act requests to find out about the basic public functioning of the commission. This does not bode well for a culture of transparent, accountable public service by the commission. Originally, I planned my trip from Toledo to Chicago for this public meeting to deliver testimony to the commission offering a story of conscience and how draft registration fails to meet a broad range of America's ideals. Because this public meeting cannot accommodate such open testimony, I stand before you hoping that a free press will shine a light on the ill-conceived and poorly executed work of the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service. Thank you.
All right. I think we'll move on. It's okay. We'll move on. It's okay. Let's keep going. Let's let the people in the audience have a chance to talk. Great.
I'm happy to follow that gentleman. I have to also talk about some harsh realities, one being the AUMF. Impacting military, national, and public service. On September 26, 2017, our Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois stated in an opinion editorial of the Wall Street Journal, quote, U.S. troops need to know that they have the full moral support and legal backing of their country. Congress hasn't given them that. Further, she states, by ignoring the AUMF for 16 years, all of us, not just lawmakers, fail to do their part of the shared responsibility of being an American citizen. I'm going to, a second point to that, the Women's March on the Pentagon scheduled for October 22, 2018 will be comprised of American citizens who are taking that responsibility. They oppose the draft for men and women. They declare the draft is a harsh burden on the poor while benefiting the wealthy and powerful. Congressional abdication of responsibility in deciding on war deprives citizens of vital representation and moral legal protections. I'll just race on to this next part. Before considering any career, volunteer, or draft pathway in the military national public service, we need to acknowledge we have a government that has gone rogue. We have to acknowledge the issues, as Smedley Butler, a U.S. Marine Corps general and two-time winner of the Medal of Honor, wrote in War as a Racket, and as President Eisenhower reminded us in his warning about the military-industrial complex in his farewell address in January 1961. We need to inform ourselves of the true nature of a country that spends more on war, less on social needs, and consistently violates human rights through militarization of police, mass incarceration, school-to-prison pipeline, indifference to youth seeking higher education, policies ignoring women's rights, and not to mention indifference to refugees displaced by militarism and the issue of climate chaos, environmental decline, ignored. And sadly, there is more. We need to ask, demand to understand where is our democracy.
Next, right over here, and then over here.
Thank you all for being here, everyone. Ladies and gentlemen of the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service, and everyone else who's come here today, my name is Matthew Nicodemus. I was born June 9th, 1960, in Evanston, Illinois, and spent most of my youth in Evanston and the wider Chicago area in the Midwest. I presently live in Boulder, Colorado. I've been a very public draft registration refuser since mandatory sign-up with Selective Service was revived in June of 1980. It has now been about 6 months since I first learned of the existence of the Commission, its stated goals, and its activities. On April 19th, I spoke at the public hearing you held in Denver, Colorado, where I related my own history of opposition and resistance to the conscription system in this country and advised you that if the U.S. government attempted to bring back the draft, it would be met with noncompliance that is already massive and would only grow larger and stronger. Today, having studied your informational materials, followed your series of public conversations across the country, communicated personally with your staff, and heard from a number of individuals and organizations that have communicated with you, I must state that you are not being open and honest with Americans about your intentions, and that you are almost certainly planning to recommend to Congress in 2020 that the nation once again have a military draft, this time through a compulsory national service program. I believe you are doing this because the United States' requirements for personnel to maintain its global military dominance and wage continuous permanent war around the world are not being met. I'll note in comment with the veterans' earlier mention of how many different places that we're involved in the world, I just read in an Atlantic article last night that last year our military personnel were reported to have been involved in 149 other countries. We have over 800 military bases around the world. I think the next country after us probably has less than 50. That might be Russia. Our armed forces are unable to recruit and retain enough volunteers, so you envision solving that problem under the guise of a program of forced public service, which promotes a variety of different compulsory service options, but makes the military service option especially attractive to conscripts, likely by requiring a shorter term of service and or offering higher salaries and benefits to those choosing the military option. The news release about this hearing, which I wrote and disseminated yesterday to Chicago area news media, I brought copies for the commission and for other people who'd like a copy, describes some of the evidence upon which I base my claims about the direction in which the commission is heading. Two specific pieces of evidence, which I'll note here, actually three. One, Bill Galvin of the Center on Conscience and War in Washington, D.C., communicated to me on June 25th, quote, "We have talked to the staff of the commission at length, and one thing the commission seems interested in is some sort of mandatory national service program. Military service would be a part of it, but it would not be military conscription per se." Two, Edward Hasbrook, the founder of Resistors.info, an organization that I also work with, responded, quote, "That's also the impression I get from the reports on the closed-door briefings and reports the commission has received, which I got in response to my Freedom of Information Act request." And three, just this evening, thanks to the description from Mr. Kazai, is it pronounced Kazai?
Casey.
To Mr. Casey, when I heard the definition of service that's been recently developed by the commission, and I hope that you can send me the wording for that exactly, when I heard that definition that was presented, I immediately thought we were being set up for for using that definition to support compulsory national service. If you are indeed considering recommending a plan of compulsory national service, and if you're considering recommending to Congress special measures to obtain for the military the trained professionals it requires in mission-critical areas, including healthcare, STEM, cyber, and foreign languages, I urge you to be honest and direct about that with the public for the duration of your mandated term, and to be responsible to them and to Congress by seeking out and paying close attention to the people who may be forced into service by a national service draft or other process of conscription. Due to limitations of time this evening, I've only stated my points in most basic form. I'll submit an expanded written version of the testimony and my April 19th statement to you before the September 30th deadline. I just want to end I can't remember who it was who mentioned that service produces a feeling of connectedness, which I really like that comment, and that resonates with my own experience. But it made me think of a Richard Pryor joke about the chances that a black man had for justice in a white police-oriented, operated jail. And it made me think of this phrase. If I say to you, when we think of the word service, if I say, "You serve us," how do you feel? Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for sharing your views. You had a comment.
Hello, everyone. My name is Michelle Okennard. I am a former public servant worker for the state of Illinois. I actually served the Roseland community for quite some time. I worked in the TANF division, which is the division for temporary assistance for needy families. So I do understand the challenge that we have today. I'd also like to thank everyone for their service in serving our country. With that said, I just wanted to ask the panel if you had considered, or for the commission, if you have considered actually developing incentives for local business owners that have community residents with these opportunity youth in it. If anyone owns a business or a small business, they can understand the challenges of cash flow and therefore being able to actually employ community residents. With my business, I own a full service event planning company here in Englewood, and it has been a challenge to find and to actually be able to employ people within the community, which is really where my heart is, because I think it's very important to not only plant business in disadvantaged communities, but to also employ those that reside in those communities to give them that opportunity. So I guess my question or my comment to pose to the commission would be to consider coming up with an incentive program or some type of funding, not only on the non-for-profit side, but also for the small business sector as well, because as we know, a lot of non-for-profits can qualify for certain funding that for-profit businesses cannot, and as a result, a lot of small businesses don't necessarily make it in the first 5 years. So I think I heard Ms. Monique comment about earlier in the discussion about partnerships, building and collaborative partnerships with local Black business owners and people of color and non-color as well that are really interested and have the heart for service. I know with my business, we give back to non-for-profit organizations. I've helped organize and create fundraisers for struggling non-for-profits because I do understand that. However, my challenge would be finding a network of volunteers or people that I can gainfully employ to sustain my business and to help in that area as well. So that would be my comment. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. And that hasn't really come up, but I appreciate you sharing that. And as Monique brought up and others, there is probably a need to connect service more to employment. And I would just encourage you, if you have specific recommendations, please submit them to us through our website. Right here, this gentleman here. Oh, there's somebody in the back. Okay, we'll go here and then in the back.
I was very impressed by a number of the speakers who are very concerned about the problems, particularly of youth, not having jobs, having mental problems, or the ex-veterans having mental problems. We're living in a city where mental health clinics have been closed. We're living in a city and a country in which trillions of dollars are being used to invade, to interfere with, to bomb, to dominate other countries in the world for the benefit of some corporations who want profits and power. And that money is not being used to have more teachers in the schools, to have more mental clinicians, to really solve all these different problems, and to be dealing with how to get more people into the military or into other compulsory service is, you're missing the main discussion needed on the agenda. And the so-called service is a fraud a lot of times. I have been in service for years and years and years, including a government program that had teachers in East Africa. And I went in good faith, only to find out that I was a tool to let the people of the East Africa know that the U.S. really does not have a serious race problem. that the U.S. is really interested in the people of the world, when they're really not. They're interested in having their tentacles in East Africa to replace the British Empire, to build a new empire. This needs to be on the agenda, and you're avoiding it. Thank you.
Can I just see hands of anyone else who wants to? We have a hand over here, a hand over there. Okay, I think these will be the last two comments because we've gone a little over time, but I want to make sure everybody who has a comment they want to make gets a chance to make a comment. So.
Hi, my name is Matthew Doljanin. I'm with Veterans for Peace. I'm a Marine Corps veteran. And as far as speaking about the draft, I think what we're missing in the point, I believe, is maybe it's time that as a country we start wondering why we are in so many wars. Why do we always engage in war? We're not very good at it, are we? Are we any good at it? How about the people at the table? You're veterans. We've been fighting in wars for, what, 5 decades? We haven't won any of these wars. We've lost in a lot of ways. We've created a lot of enemies. We're our own greatest Al-Qaeda, ISIS recruiting team by our own actions as a country. We may want to consider scaling back our illegal invasions, occupations, droning, torturing, destabilizing other countries. That's, I guess, where a lot of these refugees are coming from, ain't they? And murdering innocent men, women, children, babies, and including double taps, which are what our military is engaged in. When there's a drone bombing, they come back and they, what they do is they shoot at the medics and the rescue workers, which is pretty much what Israel's doing in Palestine right now. They practice the same tactic. We may want to consider why we have a country that is spending over $700 billion, and this speaks to this gentleman's point, on defense. Defense of what? Why do we need this money? Why do we need so much of this money? When we have people that we're kicking out of hospitals and they're roaming all over the streets, this is what our country does. And by the way, that's for all the political fighting that goes on. Passing a $700 military budget, that's a bipartisan issue, isn't it? They can agree on that. As much as this country talks about supporting its troops, it does, but it's just in rhetoric. What this country does is it engages in serial abuse of Marines and soldiers by sending them to wars they cannot win. They cannot win. And these wars are unending. There's no limit to any of these wars. We've been in Afghanistan for how long? 16, 17 years? The greatest, most powerful military force probably in the history of the world. Seriously. And we cannot win a war. I also believe it's time that we stop glorifying the military and military service. It is not the only area where people can learn traits that civilians cannot learn. This is a myth, and I think it's about time that we kind of start tapping down a lot of the glorification that goes along with that. And as a final note on veterans and veteran suicide, there was a study that came out this year. The popular belief amongst the let me ask everybody here, what is people think the leading cause of suicide by veterans is? Any guesses? It's not PTSD. It's guilt. That's the number one reason veterans kill themselves, is guilt. PTSD is the least of all reasons where veterans kill themselves. So that may be something else we might want to consider that veterans that come here back home and why they're killing themselves is because of guilt. It's the guilt. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your views. We have a comment over here. I think this will be our last comment right over here.
Hi, I'm Dr. Margot Schmidt. I'm here representing a few agencies. I run the grants department at East Aurora School District 131. We're on the east side of the Fox River. And I'm also a member of Aurora Kiwanians, and we're the seventh oldest Kiwani school organization in the nation. So I believe in service at 110%. We recently received an AmeriCorps grant, and I want to say thank you for funding that for us. And I'm so happy to be here and have been invited through them to participate in this. But I also want to tell you that we are 100% free breakfast and lunch. We feed our children five times a day through community service and backpack organizations. We have 100% wraparound services. We have a food pantry in our high school. We are winners of ICJIA's recent CVAC grant. We provide $1.5 million in youth mental health services to 14,000 kids. So I say all that to say my hardest challenge is when RFPs come out and school districts are not included. And I say that because when Aurora, being a very resource-rich city, doesn't necessarily have the money or the organizations that have the money to be able to float federal grants. So the school district, we can do that because we have the business operations behind. We have the accounting systems. We have the accountants. We have the auditors. We have the attorneys. But our non-for-profits don't. So I would just plead with you to please include school districts in any future RFPs, because you'll probably see an application from me. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your comments. And so I think we're over time, so we're going to... Okay, we'll take two more if they're very tight. All right? Two more comments, but please keep them tight because we're already over time. We get the mics here. Right here and then right here. This gentleman had his hand up first, and then this lady back here.
I wish all a good evening here, but I would call attention to the fact that we're in attending a commission that begins its rationale with military service, and the question raised to whether this should become obligatory, and the fact that we're here participating in it could be used as a means of saying that there has been a consultation about this, that our very presence is a support to conclusion that there should be such service. On the other hand, for myself, I see a basic moral obligation to state that this is not possible. I remember the announcements of the war in Iraq started off with listing the rationale given for a just war that were made through the Roman senator Cicero to claim that there is some basis for this military operation in human morality, and we need to realize that thesis is entirely devoid of validity, and that the work of a commission like yourself to make a decision on this, I would urge to see in all ways that you can that we take the resources that we're putting in and robbing from people and to rob from the world to better uses.
Okay. Thank you. So I was just informed that we appreciate that Kennedy King College has hosted us, but we are over time in terms of AV and using the room. So we'll have this last comment from this lady who put her hand up first, and then we're going to have to wrap. And for anybody else who wants to have a comment, we ask you to please submit it through our website.
Hello, everybody. I'd like to raise the question, who should decide?
Who should decide whether we send our youth, especially our impoverished youth, to fight in wars against people who have not attacked us? Who should decide? Should this commission try to buffalo us into believing that they're really finding out what people think? To find out what American citizens think, the best way is to look at polls, because polls over and over again have shown that the overwhelming majority of American citizens oppose these endless aggressive wars. We cannot wait for the commission to advise Congress, et cetera, and have them decide. Because who are they? The congressmen and the president are warmongers. They have consistently voted for war, funded war. And who are they? Who do they represent? They do not represent me. They do not represent working people. They represent the people who fund their campaigns. Wars are not for the benefit of working people. Wars are for the benefit of the rich, poor and simple. This commission is illegitimate because it pretends to try to give us a say. In fact, we have no decision-making power, and we have to take to the streets to say, no more wars of aggression, not one more youth for aggressive war. We want our children safe. We don't want them to be trained to be killers. We don't want them sent against people who are not their enemies. I want to say once again, to find out what people think, you cannot find out any other way than actually counting. And we have polls taken by many, many organizations over and over. The people say we are against aggressive U.S. wars.
All right. All right. Well, I want to thank everyone for coming out tonight. Could you please join me in once again thanking our panelists? And I want to thank Kennedy King College. So we are, this commission is traveling around the country. If you didn't get a chance to share everything, if you wrote out a statement, please submit that to our staff, submit it to our website, make comments. We are, cards back here. One of our staff people is holding up the box for cards. We're going to continue to travel the country. We are in a fact-finding mode right now and appreciate all the comments that everybody had to share. We're going to be going to Texas, to California, and we're going to continue to do outreach. And very much are interested in your point of view and appreciate you spending your Thursday evening with us. So thank you very much. Thank you for joining us.